You're listening to the good.
Don't call me Paino.
The bad.
Absolute.
And the rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord, and the Husk. I don't know what that means.
Hello, everybody. Welcome along once again to a special edition this time of The Good, The Bad, and The Rugby. Just a little something to keep you ticking over between Christmas and New Year. We all hope you've enjoyed yourselves. Hope you've had a good time. Hope you've found peace and harmony and fun and games in amongst all of the madness in the first part of the festive period. And that Father Christmas brought you everything that you might want, might need, and might have been hoping for. Fingers crossed for something a little bit better for all of us in 2021. I'm just also wondering how many of you might have got a very good, solid rugby autobiography, some very good ones released in 2020, of course, from the likes of Joe Marler and, of course, Dylan Hartley and one or two others. No James this week, no Mike this week, and no Ellis, who's got a very good excuse in that he's hopefully going to be playing some rugby. Just me, a script, and a little bit of an echo chamber as per. And we've also assembled over the last 3 or 4 months or so, a raft of superstar guests who have been answering your questions. If you haven't seen it, where have you been? We've been running a series called Ask Me Anything with the great and the good of the game across our social media channels and on YouTube. And this is just a chance to collate some of the best and put them together in one delicious pie. Just type in good, bad and rugby into your search engine of choice. We're always very easy to find. That goes to our website where you'll discover our range of T-shirts and hoodies. Perfect, of course, for any member of the family that you didn't buy for before Christmas because you were using the change in tier systems as your excuse. Now is the time to get it done. Anyway, this week's episode is an extension of that series, as we said. So let's kick it off with what oddly seemed like the most popular topic, and that was beards and haircuts. So here are Luke Cowan-Dickie, Xander Fagerson, Lewis Ludlam, Alex Corbusiero, and first of all, Mr. Brad Shields.
Question one, it was great to see take the beard off for a good cause and donate to Lucid, but how much does he miss the beard? Good, I won't say that. It's his good looking head underneath the beard, but I won't say that. I do miss it actually, because I don't know if it's, my mum always told me when I was younger, your haircut sort of represents your attitude a little bit. So when I came home with a mohawk one day, she wasn't very happy because, no offense when with a mohawk out there, like I would still rep a mohawk, but she thought I was being a bit sort of a smart ass in that since I got it. So I thought my beard sort of, it was like maybe it was a front, like trying to be a tough guy, I don't know, but manly sort of thing. So yeah, I do miss it, I guess, but I had it for a long time. I had it for 6 years. So it was time to come off and enjoy a bit of freedom, although the shaving regularly or trimming regularly does get a bit boring sometimes. But no, I definitely miss it. But for great cause for loose heads, and I'm so glad I did shave it off for those guys. And they've been great in what they do out in the community and what they do in the mental health space and tackling the stigma. So more than happy for their great cause. And maybe one day I'll grow it back and we can shave my hair and my beard off.
Why did I shave my beard? I shave my beard because every time I grow it long, Mrs. hates it. She nags at me for months and months. So I bit the bullet and cut it off, and it was one of the worst decisions I made.
Rate the hairstyles of Ollie Kebble, Aki Sueli, and Tom Gordon in best to worst order. I'll go Tom Gordon for me is the best. Just suits a mullet down to a T, you know. Crazy Kiwi, sun boy as well, and the luscious locks. He's been growing it for about 3 years, so it's good to see it actually come through. Proper hillbilly, absolutely love it. Ollie, maybe second. He's kind of hard to miss that bleach blonde locks, you know. But yeah, fingers crossed doesn't die again because he's quite a good looking brunette, but we'll leave it at that. Aki, yeah, I don't know why he's playing at. He's got spaghetti hair. I think he dyed it himself. He thinks he's a great barber and he's absolutely hanging. So he's done a few of the boys, probably the worst phase I've ever seen, but nah, he's all good, but yeah, maybe not. It helps you stick out to the ref, which I don't know why you do it, but I'll get my black scrum caps if he wears it.
Rob London, where is the beard at? It's on its way back, I promise. It makes me look more Arabic than I am, having the beard. But yeah, I mean, I shaved it off from November, obviously trying to raise a bit of money with the England boys, which I don't think my mum was too happy with. Obviously, she liked me raising the money, but I don't think she was too keen on the on the moustache, or what was trying to be a moustache. So yeah, that went pretty quickly, and I'm trying to grow back the beard just a little bit, some loose stubble as we speak.
This next question is from @atown1022. Make sure you follow that @atown1022. That is the boss of my life, the one and only Abby Gastidis. But her question is, what is the likelihood I find 10,000 more beard hairs while cleaning the bathroom when you haven't been here in 3 months? And then in capitals, and you have no hair. Well, unfortunately, Abby, it's probably pretty high. I'm going to be real with you, as we've come to discover, leaving beard hairs around is one of my shortcomings in this partnership, which I'm sure you've got a long list of them. Right now is nothing to worry about. So hopefully when I do get back, there's still a little bit of grace time where, you know, you don't take it too hard on me. But, you know, come on, babe. You love it. You love it. You love this. No, she doesn't. No, she doesn't. Now she's nodding.
Well, a nice little assortment there for you. And if you weren't asking about body hair, you wanted to know how to make it as a pro. So here are Xander, Brad, Corbs and Hask on how you can get a game at elite level.
Best thing for me would just be to do work on your basic skills, you know, that catch pass, work on your tackling technique, you know, foot in the hoop and all that, making sure you wrap your arms. And then, yeah, just keep enjoying the game and that will grow, you know, kicking and stuff. It's not my forte, but I'll dabble in it when I can. A few chip and chases back in the day at number 8, but not an 8 prop. So, yeah, just keep enjoying your rugby and working your catch and pass and just play as much as you can.
Next question. Any tips for an aspiring back rower? I reckon my biggest tip is definitely, it's a talent-free one. This is about hard work and making sure you work harder than everybody else, because I think you'll know, especially in the England setup, some of the best back rowers in the world even definitely have a better work rate, or the best work rate on the field. So I reckon, you know, get that base fitness and definitely try and be the guy that works that little bit harder, or girl, sorry, that works that little bit harder than everybody else. So, yeah, that's probably my biggest tip. Hard work definitely outweighs talent sometimes.
I respect you so much, Alex. Do you have any advice for me on going pro? I'm an under-15s level player and would love your opinion on how to go professional. Well, Charlie, thanks very much for the kind words. There's probably two ways to get about it. I think the best way is things that you can control are the way you approach your sort of journey through rugby. I think it's a marathon, not a sprint. I think the biggest advice I could give to you is every training session, every game, everything. Every training session, you want to be learning. You want to be growing. It wants to be purposeful. You want to be getting better at something. Every game, you want to enjoy, but you also want to review, learn, what can I do better? I think that sort of growth mindset of constantly improving and not worrying about if some people are a little bigger than you or more physical than you or whatever at 15, 16, those things work themselves out when you're older, but it's your basics, your catch pass, your breakdown, your reading, all the things that you can keep improving with every minute you spend on the training field. Those things are going to best prepare you, and that mindset is best going to prepare you for when you get an opportunity to be in a professional environment. The other thing is, as well, is trying to get recognized, and it's not always easy, but getting to the county level, getting to the academies. I know they do these DPP sort of encatchment things where you can turn up, get your head in there, get recognized, try and get into your sort of academies encatchment depth chart, and just keep going about your business. Because even once they have you in the depth chart, you might not be in an under 15, 16s, but if you keep that sort of mindset and improving, by the time 18s comes around, you're still in that pool to get scooped up. And that would be my advice. And good luck with everything.
Charlie Goodright Moss, one of Alex Payne's mates, clearly. What's your advice for a young player intending to go pro? First of all, is, you know, relax. There is a 1%, 2% chance of you ever making it professional. And why I made it versus somebody else is anyone's guess. You know, injury, luck, right place at the right time play a role. What you can do your end to make sure that you do well is you can put the extra work in every single day. So break the game down into different core skills. No one ever got, you know, made a professional rugby player by having a mega body in the gym. It doesn't work, because if it was, I'd be captain of the world of rugby, and I obviously wasn't. So, you know, you need to break it down: handling, carrying, running lines, high balls, kicking, passing from the floor, you know, offloading, running position, ball carrying, speed, all these areas, and every single day work for 10 to 15 minutes extra every, you know, after every session to be professional. Find rugby players you aspire to be. Watch a lot of them on TV. You know, we have a lot of coverage now, so you can, you know, young players can stop, watch. You know, when I was younger, or when I was getting better, you know, wanting to get better, I'd watch a bit of footage of Richie McCaw, you know, Michael Hooper, Pocock, you know, Lawrence Lalio, Richard Hill, Joe Worsley, and I would watch these guys continuously to see what I could do, and I would try stuff in training and also enjoy it. Enjoy your rugby. Stop worrying about which school you're going to go to put you in the best shot window for rugby, because if you get tackled the first day and your knee falls off, what are you going to do then? You can become a McDonald's drive-through specialist, but there's no point paying all that money on your education or going to a really good school and coming out of it just being good at rugby. Try to be all-rounded.
And it wasn't just regular fans who wanted answers either. Time and again, friends, family and teammates would pop up with the hot topics that they needed answered.
All right, here we go. It's one for Nosey. Shock. Any chance of getting him to cut his grass, pick up the dog shit and put his rubbish in the wheelie bin? I can smell it from mine. Making the drive look messy, I'm not having it. Right. That's a load of bollocks. Maybe the dog shit will be right. But my dog, I have two dogs and they shit, I reckon, 8-10 times a day, boys. So I'm talking, I have to pick a dustbin load up each day. Bin-wise, I've only actually got one bin. Now, obviously, in the end, I'll have two bins. So the issue is, obviously, they've got a lot of space. So I normally just leave my bins by the side of mine and then just fill theirs up after. Don't tell them that, obviously.
Z, this is my mate Z, Elema. She is obsessed with Earl Grey and she knows exactly what I like. So I don't know, this is not even a real question. So her question is literally Earl Grey or Tetley, question mark, you must pick one. That's not an option. Obviously it's going to be Tetley because I don't like Earl Grey. But I think she's just done that to get a reaction from me and get her name on the pod. But we all got to play the game, right?
In this one, I'm a bit reluctant to say, but it's my wife. She said, when will you wash your training gear when you get home instead of leaving it on the floor? Now, she's being very cheeky here because 9 times out of 10, I'm the one who does the washing in the house. I'm the one who does all the washing, the sheets, the kids' clothes, everything. So I'm just going to leave it right there.
There's a couple from Genji here, which I'm not reading out. I refuse to play Genji's games. He says, I'll read this one. Why do you always ask me to buy games, play them, then you stop playing after a day? The thing with Genji, right, is he's got all these good ideas about all these games we can play, and I've always followed him in. He's the one who always says, okay, buy this game, buy that, we'll play it, especially when you're on camp and you've got so much time to spare. We just find our way through loads of different games. And I mean, I'll give you an example. World of Warcraft, I think we spent about 2 hours trying to pick different characters on camp. I picked a character which I was really happy with, and Genji wasn't happy with his character. And because Genji wasn't happy with his character, we both had to stop playing. That's the type of bloke Genji is. So it's not me changing the game. It's Genji playing the game, not happy with the choice he's making, and then us having to switch something else. So it's all Genji's fault in terms of that.
Luke Cowan-Dickey, Shauna Brown, Brad Shields, and Lewis Ludlam with the answers there. Plenty of you wanted to know about Nights Out, Nauses, and varying levels of chat. Fortunately, we did have the right people in place. So here again, Messrs. Cowan-Dickey, Fagerson, and Ludlam.
Jack Noel's got awful chat. Henry Slade has got awful chat and stinky breath. So them two are really up there.
Great question coming in now. Night Out, Ali Price or Adam Hastings? Well, first of all, they both would be on their phone and take so long to get ready that they're both probably not the best. But I'll go with Hasto because he's a good dancer and he thinks he's hilarious. So he's always good fun. But they're both good guys and they're both good for a night out.
Who is the biggest rugby nose in the Saints squad from Ragtop DOS? Oh God, there's a few different sort of noses. There's the noses that just want to chat rugby, and then there's a few people who are just nosy at loads of other different things. So Jimmy Grayson is a pretty nosy bloke when it comes to rugby. Doesn't shut up about code. Who else is there? George Furbank, definitely. I mean, his whole life revolves around rugby. He's gonna kill me for saying this. First time I went to his house, I mean, we must have been about, I think I was 19, he was at 18 at the time. He just signed that Saints and was like training with the first team, whatever, and he still had a poster of Ben Foden up in his bedroom. And I swear on my life, I'm not making that up. I think that was a Johnny Wilkinson book by his bedside table as well. So in terms of naughty behaviour, I think George Furbank has got to be up there.
Well, not a good look by all accounts for George Furbank. Some of the best answers came when the players, though, were forced to turn back the clock. Here are Corbs and Tins on some of their greatest career moments.
This question's from Chris Evans. What was your most memorable moment in your rugby career? For me, I think it's obvious it's going to be that third test of the Lions. I just can't see how I could put any of the sort of memories higher than that. My most memorable moment in that game is when Ben Alexander got the yellow card and then eventually didn't come back on, but that yellow card. I'd missed the first test. I thought we did a decent job, but I pulled my calf in the warm-up. and I played 60 minutes or so with it, but it was bothering me a bit. And I felt at scrum time we were dominant, but we let them off the hook a little bit. And I felt that was because I couldn't quite get spot on perfect detail to sort of go for the kill. In the second test, I had to rest and missed it. And I thought Mako was young at that point and he maybe out street smarted him a little bit, got some cheap penalties that ended up costing us the game in a tight game where it went down to sort of kicks. And so as I came back to fitness, got picked for that third test, the morning of that test ended up being with Gats in the dining room, going to grab a bottle of water. I see him and he looks at me and he goes, "Will you just get that prick for me today?" You know, I looked at him and said, "Mate, I'll get him for you." And obviously Roundtree was the scrum coach at that time, who was a massive mentor to me and almost like a second or third, Count Neil Hatley as well, sort of rugby dad for me. And to go out there and sort of put that wrong right and, you know, shore up that area and get the ins that we needed in that game and the pressure that we built off of it, but also to put the statement that, you know, Roman Poit rewarded us and pinged him for some of the stuff he'd been doing. I'd say for me, that was probably the icing on the cake and the most memorable moment, because I felt I was always the type of player that played for my coaches and wanted to sort of, they invested in me, I invested in them. But also I think at the set piece, I put a lot of time and hours into, you know, honing that craft and to sort of be able to execute it on the top or the highest level I got to play, I think as well, it means a lot for me.
Someone said, "Mike, excluding 2003 final, what would be your high and low point wearing the England shirt? And who did you most admire as a teammate during your England career?" The high point, I think 2003 as a year would be the high point, I think. Winning the Grand Slam, then going to the Southern Hemisphere and winning those two games against Australia and New Zealand in their back garden, you know, 3 months before the World Cup, was massive for us, sort of mentally. But also, I give a shout out to the summer of 2000 when we went to South Africa and we got our first win against some Hemisphere team on their soil for a long time. So that, from that point on, we didn't lose to a Southern Hemisphere team until after the World Cup in 2003. So 3 years of not losing to New Zealand or Australia and South Africa is quite impressive, and Argentina. So those would be the highs. The lows, pretty easy for me. The one that sticks out most is losing that first Grand Slam game against Scotland. You know, first year in an England jersey full time, and that one stung. Duncan Hodge, headlines, slam dunk. That would probably be the lowest point. But then you could add sort of the years post 2003, where we weren't winning many games and things were a lot tougher. They were pretty low too. 2004, 2005, 2006. They were quite low as well.
And when it comes to Tins, the most asked questions were around the royal family, which understandably he wasn't touching. And the second most popular subject was that tackle on George Gregan in the 2003 Rugby World Cup final.
Did you just think, sod it, you're having it here? Not really. So basically, if you look at it back, the whistle had gone. He was in touch anyway. So it would have, probably nowadays, it'd be a card of which colour, I'll let you decide. But no, I was, once I had heard the whistle go as I'd picked him up, and I was going to put him down, but then there was Neil Bax shouting behind me, "Just smash him," and then he pushed me in the back as well, just to help me along my way. So there was something in my brain that did say let him have it, but then it was mainly Backy shouting at me that made me do it, so I blame Backy.
One question that elicited a very interesting answer was sent to the England and Harlequins tight head, Shauna Brown.
"Do you feel the women's squad is tucked away a bit? Can see there's some amazing characters there. Bots, Hannah Botterman, being one, but can't help but feel they're allowed to express themselves publicly just yet. In 2020, girls and women aspiring to play need that comedy and diverse acceptance that everyone is welcome openly on display, don't we?" So basically, Angelique just wants me to big up Bots, which I can do. She's a big character. She's an entertainer. She's a good girl. I feel like she expresses herself. Maybe it's because when we're in camp, we spend a lot more personal time together, and it's necessarily not what you guys see on camera. But she's very much, well, you'd have to ask her specifically, seeing as we're mentioning her. But I feel she expresses herself quite a lot. She says things out loud sometimes. You think, oh, I wouldn't have said that. But like, she does. So she's obviously happy and comfortable. Are people allowed to express themselves publicly? I feel like that's that's put on by individuals feeling that they can't say that. So one of the comments I get is like, I can't believe you get away with saying these sorts of things. And I go, well, they don't get to say what they want to say. I'm like, well, what do you want to say? Well, I don't know. Say what you want to say. And if there's repercussions, there's repercussions. And even then, like, you can still say it, but just maybe change how you say it. So I do acknowledge that I get away with things sometimes, but even with getting away with it, I'm very deliberate with my words. Also, top tip, you say anything with a smile on your face, you normally get your way. People love a smile. Even if you're giving them bad news, you just go like, or someone's telling you off and you just smile at them. They go, like coaches, Shauna, why did you do that? Oh, I don't know. I tried really hard. I go, oh, okay, I can't be angry at you now.
Shauna Brown there. Alex Corbusiero was also sent some fascinating questions on the state of the game in the United States. Here are three of the best, starting with whether a university draft system that works for most major US sports would perhaps bring more profile to rugby union.
I do in some ways, but for that to happen, I have like my own thoughts on how I would redraw up the academy sort of development system in English rugby. So it does entail a draft. So yes, in short form, but now you're going to get the long form answer of why I think that. So for me, obviously with the financial burdens of COVID, but also just in general with the fact that most rugby clubs aren't incredibly profitable, I don't believe Premiership rugby clubs should actually have their own academies. I think as well as the sport is getting harder and harder, more physical, more games, career spans are going to get shorter. I actually would kind of mimic an American model, but hybrid it, that I would actually have the RFU partner with universities and have sort of regional academies in these universities. So depending on where you grow up, you're in catchment area, as you're in school, you have your RFU development training that's based at these, while you're at school, still at these university facilities. Then you go to university in sort of these regional academies that are based at certain unis. Those unis then play in a league against each other, which ends up being like the top sort of level of college rugby as such, mimicking, say, college football in America. Those sort of regional academies, you do your 3 years, and then in theory, you're eligible for the draft, which then all the premiership teams would draft. I think then every team is a fair pick. They can pick who they want based on their depth charts. The teams that finish lower in the league will get the first choice of some of the talent. I also think that then players, if they're forwards or maybe not quite developed yet, could carry on and do masters and still be eligible to the draft till 23 or whatever it is, similar to what you can do in the United States. I believe you can play till 25 and so in your 5 years of eligibility. So a university degree and a master's kind of fits quite well in that. These players get a degree. If they get spit out of the machine, they actually have a degree, they have a time. They're going to play. The age group coaches of the RFU will be linked with these regional academies. They'll have access to the 18s and 20s. Those seasons will become even more, not a full time, but a proper season as well. You have your college windows. I think that's marketable on TV. That makes money for the universities and the RFU revenue. And then the premiership clubs don't have to worry about any of that infrastructure. They are literally just picking players from that sort of level of when they get them in the system at 20, 21. I think the earliest, if you start at 17 or 16, is 19. I don't think you should be playing any first team rugby any sooner than that. And then I think it's a way of sort of offsetting the cost of the premiership. You have a draft, which would be exciting, which people could watch. And you kind of build a university sort of sport in there that builds revenue and stuff as well. And then players are actually educated and have an option after life if an injury happens, or they don't get picked up instead of going into academies at the age of 16, 17, hoping all their eggs are one basket, do 3-4 years, get spat out. Now the championship's pretty much gone and defunded. It's not as viable option as it was. You're kind of left trying to find a trade at that point. It's very hard. I have a lot of friends that fell into that gap. I started with 17 kids in the London Irish Academy, and by 20, only three of us remained and were on our way to the first team. So I kind of have a different view of that, but that would be how I would restructure the rugby long term. And I think it's commercially more viable that you actually could put together a competitive uni product where the best youth players are all there. And I also think foreign players would come, South Africans, other people would come to our uni system and play in some of these teams, because you're going to need numbers as well as the kids that are in the regional academy. And then also they have the 5 years to get in catchment. And I think it benefits England rugby multi-phase. So that's my complex plan, but that's what I would do if I had a charge, I was in charge, or at least had a ability to suggest something.
What do you think the biggest hurdle facing American rugby is? There's a lot of hurdles facing rugby in America. I think it has actually managed to climb so many hurdles that have been maybe holding it back, and slow and steady progress of starting to get over them. I think the biggest hurdle that Americans need to climb is finding a way into the high school sports calendar. I can't underestimate. I think the viewership, the visibility of rugby, getting on main broadcasters, like a lot of the work I do with NBC Sports, MLR is on multiple platforms, even Pro 14 and the Bledisloe Cup and the Rugby Championship, all that is starting to get exposure in the US. And if you're a rugby fan and you know about it, you can find it, which I think in the last 5 years, if you went 5-6 years ago, that wouldn't be the case. The World Cup was all available. Where I think the game needs to grow is probably two areas. One of them would be the information share of coaching. I think sometimes there's a time delay of sort of what sort of coaches or players or environments at the top level, but even sort of some of the more club level and grassroots levels are coaching, say, in more of the rugby-centric countries, getting that information share and finding a way of coach education and connecting that information to America, to the people that are doing the grassroots coaching that are sort of guiding this next generation, I thought is invaluable with a digital age, with the ability of Zoom, with all of that online coaching and information share. I think that's an area that can really be well done. And then the other thing is getting it into the high school sports season. I think there are so many athletes. The athlete pool in America, there is, you know, it's no surprise, there's no shortage of athletes. There's players that play 2-3 sports, end up finding the one that they go the furthest in, and that's where they go. I think finding a way that rugby can get in that calendar, where even if it's an 8-week window, where players at least know the rules, even if it's touch, understand the concept, have the catch, pass, ball skills, breakdown work, kicking. If they can add all those things, or understand what a scrum is, or understand a line out, having that sort of familiarity with the sport, and then having an ability for USA Rugby or other rugby programs such as MLR, college programs, to track these players on their way. And as they drop out of the D1 sports, football, baseball, basketball, wrestling, all things like that that get you college scholarships and get you a free ride to college, as you sort of whittle down your pathways or you find your way in college and can't go to the pros, having sort of an attachment net of tracking these players and then steering them back to rugby. Because a gifted athlete, you can make a rugby player, but it takes time. And if they already have a base knowledge in the sport, it takes so much less time to convert them back over and get them in a high performance environment and help steer them. And I think from a USA Rugby point of view, these areas that need to happen, because America needs to be as competitive as possible. I think the growth factors of them are being competitive long-term on the world stage. If you can get the American patriotism, the catalyst of getting behind a national team at, say, a World Cup, where one day they can be a contender in a group, if it's a home World Cup, all these factors will be huge catalysts for the sport to grow. You can see Sevens has done a tremendous job, that the US are, in men and women's, are competitive at the top of the world in Sevens. It is growing the fan base. It gets big viewership on NBC. It is a great window to the sport and a great ambassador to getting Americans more familiar with rugby. And I think the more and more that we can get America competitive, the more and more fans will be drawn in on sort of these big world events where they love to get behind the red, white and blue. Next question is from Samuel Kurtz, 27. How far off from winning a World Cup are the USA Eagles? As much as I'd like to say not far off, it's going to take some time to win a World Cup for the USA Eagles. You know, realistically, might not be something that happens for decades. But I think the goal is to get competitive at a World Cup, to be in a group where there is a chance for the quarterfinals. Could potentially be two World Cup cycles away, with MLR improving, better international coaches, more American players getting professionalized, more top international players playing over there, so they're playing with those. It gives the coaching system a base level of sort of players to pick from, to select from, as well as the top players that go and play international, which are invaluable to the US as well. And I do think when you sort of reach the sort of peak in the MLR, the next step is to go international and test yourself there. And I think there's a number of factors that need to be layered on top of that. I think the fact that the MLR is developing sort of academies, youth, grassroots, all that's going to play it up as well. I think the fact that more and more rugby is on TV, more fans, more commercial viability, all of that stuff's going to help. But I think really the US almost have to figure out their rugby calendar as well. I think that's part of the thing that needs to happen as well, is that right now it's a little bit mixed. They play, you know, some of the Northern Hemisphere, some of the Southern Hemisphere. I think that with the MLR there, there's an opportunity to align the schedule, probably more likely with the Southern Hemisphere, and playing in some sort of tier two rugby championship that maybe eventually has an option at promotion or something. And you can actually build, you know, you've got your MLR calendar, your USA rugby calendar, international windows, and you actually have a sort of model that you can go and get sponsors, commercialize, because they need more support, they need more revenue, they need more analysts, coaches, S&C. Everything is being done on a budget at the moment, and I think you have to find sort of the commercial plan that some and the sort of TV rights plan and everything around that that supports the growth as well as everything that's going on the field. And I think that's going to take some time. I do think a home World Cup will be a massive catalyst for growth. If they can do that, and is it the 2031? Yeah, I think 2027 might be too close, if I'm honest, for them to be competitive. But if they have a home World Cup and they're competitive and they say they somehow do a Japan and get to a quarterfinal, that would be massive for the sport. And I think that would inspire a next generation of players to pick up the game that played from a young age that then might one day have a shot at a World Cup win. But that this is a long build. It's a slow build. It's a tiered up. And it's going to take a lot of time to build the foundations to be able to build that. But again, we are miles ahead of where we were when I first came back to the US 4.5 years ago. And I do think we're moving in the right direction. But realistically, those are sort of the things that need the hurdles that need to be done for the sport to ever get to the point where they can compete with the top nations in the world.
Well, definitely an interesting challenge awaiting the US as it builds towards what everyone expects to be a Rugby World Cup. And they will obviously be looking to try and grow the game via the MLR in the meantime as well. Of course, it was Ask Me Anything, as we said, so there were one or two questions that very much tick the random boxes.
Question three I've got is it true cows can't walk downstairs? I don't know if they can or can't, and they can't walk over cattle grids, so maybe. Can crocodiles really climb trees? Yeah, go for it. No idea. Good question.
Who was your favourite Spice Girl? Oh, jeez. I don't really listen to the Spice Girl, I have to admit. I'd probably say something like Sporty Spice, just because I was sporty at school, I guess.
Kieran Phillips, if you could punch anyone in the face with no repercussions, who would it be? Who would I want to punch in the face? Oh, God. It's a really interesting one. There's no one in the rugby world I want to punch in the face. I think some... Oh, I'll tell you who I'd like to punch in the face. Some of those Americans that... evangelical Americans I'd quite like to punch in the face. You know, the ones that stand outside like soldiers' funerals and the guy was getting like, you're going to hell! Someone like that. I'd love to just run my pickup truck. Just punch him in the face. The pickup truck was a bit aggressive.
Someone's asked the question, what do I think about the pedestrianisation of Norwich? It's a great question. Something I've thought on a lot, but for me, I'm dead against it. People forget that traders need access to Dixons.
Well, he's certainly got a point. Although Dixons became defunct in 2014, Tins, do keep up with the times. Anyway, moving away from former electrical retailers, a lot of you were keen to know about what happens on international duty. So here's Luke Cowan-Dickie, Shauna Brown, and first of all, Lewis Ludlam on Playing for Your Country.
When you first came into the England setup, what was it like working with the senior members? Is Owen as hard a taskmaster as everyone says? Yeah, I think that was the biggest eye-opener from going from club rugby to international rugby. Is a switch in mindset, I think, between how players criticise each other. I mean, I think if sometimes at club things get heated on the pitch because people don't think things are going the right way or things should be done different ways. But at the club, everyone's on the same page and everyone's demanding such high standards of each other. And Owen was probably the one that was leading that from the boys. So he's one of these guys that it's done his way and he demands high standards. And I think that's how he understands. That's how you get the best out of a team. And I think that's probably one of the things that helped us massively to go out as far as we did in that setup about not being afraid to demand standards from each other and us as one cap, two caps, three caps, being able to demand standards from him as well. And for him to sort of take stuff on board from what us younger lads were saying or less experienced lads were saying as well, just goes to show that it was always about trying to be on the same page and trying to get the best out of the squad. So yes, he is a hard taskmaster, definitely, but it's definitely to the benefit of the team and that whole culture of being an international environment. Definitely England is sort of built around that, which has been really positive and something we're trying to take back to the club as well.
Who do I hang around with in the England camp? There's a few boys, to be fair. I hang around with most of them. You know, Genji obviously is a big gamer. I'm a gamer, so we hang around quite a bit. Obviously, a few of the exit boys, Jamie George, quite a bit. He's quite a funny character. So if you feel down, you just go and speak to that guy.
Country best roommate. This is a tricky one for me because I've had two main chicks. You have mains. Because you have your regulars, it makes you feel in a safe space. When you go, I tell you what you don't want to be, a little bit off topic, but what you don't want to be is unsure as to who your roommate is. You want to have your go-to, your set roommate, like your home girl, your room girl. You need that in your life. If you come into camp and you don't have a roommate, or you're that person who sort of has been shifted out because you've either missed a couple of camps or someone else has not been around and you don't know who your roommate's going to be from camp to camp, that's not a place you want to be. Luckily, never been that person, because even when I first come into camp, I had Rachel Burford, and I'll let you know, she won't like this. She actually asked me to be her roommate. Yeah. First camp and Burf asked me to be her roommate. I know, crazy. And yeah, she's a great human being. She's like my Yoda. I go to her, even for now, for anything in life. If I've got moral dilemmas, if I'm not sure how to ask certain questions or talk to certain people, or I need to check my moral compass sometimes, I have to check with her. But now my go-to, my home girl, my room girl is Sarah Beckett, although not now because of COVID, we have our own rooms, which is a bonus in itself. But it would be Sarah Beckett, and she's my girl. It's different. They're different to each other. If I had to pick one, okay, I'm going to go with Sarah Beckett because she keeps me young. I am getting old. Sarah Beckett's a lot younger than me. She keeps me young. Okay, sorry, said it. Sorry, Beth, love you too. And worst, it's got to be, I think worst is a strong word. Most standout entertainment, possibly. Someone who I wouldn't want to be regular with, that's the easiest way I can put it, is someone we used to call CP. Her name's Charlotte Pierce. Hyperactive. I think I'm hyper. No. I can be hyper outside of the room door. As soon as I step in the door, it's like it's chill time, big lights off, just got the side lights on, we're just chilling. CP? No. Lights are on, music's on, 9 o'clock's gone. Are you on a glass of water, CP? No, it's right, I've got my Lucozade and I've got Coke for later. CP, it's 10 o'clock at night. And then she'd be surprised as to why she's like, I've just got so much energy all the time. I don't know what to do. I'm like, maybe the Lucozade doesn't help. I don't know, I'm no expert. So there you go.
One of the more unusual things that we unearthed during this series was how close Lewis Ludlam came to becoming a daytime TV star.
So this one's from LOL261983. Are you still going on Bargain Hunt? Which is definitely why I answered that question. Probably sitting at home watching Bargain Hunt himself. Yeah, well, this is the thing. So I was meant to go on Bargain Hunt basically the week before I was going to the World Cup. So I'd agreed to going on, and me and Alex Mitchell had signed up about a year and a half before. I never expected to get anything back. And of all time in, they literally messaged me. I got a call saying, do you still fancy it before the World Cup? And I sort of said, yeah, well, yeah, I've got sort of a few things on now. Apologies. And they said that they'd like to get me back on in the future. So that's still in the works. I'm just looking for the right time to do it. Obviously, COVID's probably set that back a little bit. But it's still in my plans for sure, and something I'm excited about getting involved in. Not that I'm a massive Bargain Hunt fan, but I think we just fancy giving it a crack. I mean, how hard could it be?
Well, it certainly could start a new trend. Perhaps Owen Farrell on The Chase, Kyle Sinclair on Holmes Under the Hammer, and Hask on The Hidden Camera Show. Moving swiftly on. Sportsmen and women are often very talented at other disciplines. Tins is very good at golf. Ellis at gaming. James, what else, though, could our guests have made it as a pro in?
I think realistically, if I'm realistically where I think I might have a chance, I'd have to go darts. I'm very much a pub sportman. Misspent youth, where I feel most at home. So I think it would be darts I'd go for.
If you could play any other sport professionally, which would you choose and why? I used to do a bit of mountain biking, believe it or not, when I was a bit slimmer, and I absolutely loved it. It was downhill, so the weight did help, but it was harder to stop as well. But yeah, I'd love to do downhill mountain biking, give it a go. You know, I've got a few mates who did it and got to see the world and stuff, and it's a pretty cool sport, so I'd definitely give that a bash in a different life. Maybe not after rugby, because I'll probably be broken, but we'll see how we go.
Tins and Xander Fagerson there. Perhaps the most eye-opening answer came from Hask, though, on the most embarrassing thing that he has ever seen on the pitch.
I've seen a teammate shit himself. That was pretty horrific. A bit of a runny tummy, went into a tackle, shat himself, and ran straight off the field into the change room, which is never good. I won't name him, because it's a bit shameful. Richard Burkett was his name.
Somehow, that answer seems the perfect way to set up these final two clips. Here at GBR, we can't seem to do anything without the stench of Archie Curzon permeating through everything. The failed pop star was asked two questions by you, the audience. Who has the best rig on the Good, Bad and Rugby?
Well, the Fridges rig is in incredible nick. Actually, I have a photo of him in my bedroom, cut out from Hello Magazine when he was on holiday with Chloe. And yeah, he's just always in great shape. Someone I look up to in the rig area. Tins' rig, to be fair, is pretty good. He's got a fairly good chassis. He could still look good in the beach. So fair play to him. Pano looks like someone who plays hockey. And that sort of sums up Pano's chassis.
And who would he rather fight? One duck-sized... actually believe we're having to read this out. Who would he rather fight? One duck-sized Pano or 10 Pano-sized ducks? Frankly, who gives a duck?
Interesting question. I'm guessing this guy must smoke a wacky backy. Probably just fight 10 ducks looking like Pano. I mean, I could have Pano in my sleep. I'm hoping that me and him arrange a charity bout and we end it once and for all. You know, I'll probably give him the old 1-2 and then uppercut. I was known at boarding school for being pretty good at fisticuffs. And actually, on a night out, I've had some near incidents. But luckily, I've got the old pitter-patter and I managed to, you know, get my way out of it. So, you know, these are deadly weapons. Don't want to use them.
Well, on that mess of a finale, that is it for our final special episode of The Good, The Bad and The Rugby in 2020. Hopefully, that keeps you ticking over until next week, where we'll be back with another crackerjack of a guest, a proper big-time player in the last 10 years or so. Don't forget our GBNR Premiership preview show with betuk.com. That's over on our YouTube channel. Astonishingly, Monsieur Hask got all four of his bets right last week. Well done if you followed him blindly into his betting. Tins and I will be here later in the week looking ahead to the weekend's games that will be going ahead. Fingers crossed, COVID depending. If you do want to join in, it really couldn't be any simpler to get started with the official Premiership Rugby Predictor app, available exclusively on betuk.com's app on iOS and Android. Simply download the app from the Apple App Store or Google Play Store, wherever it is that you do your apping. Number two, register or log in to your betuk.com account through the betuk.com app. Number three, select the Premiership Rugby Predictor from the menu. Number four, make your prediction of a home win, a draw or an away win for all six of the weekend's Premiership fixtures. And number five, submit your predictions ahead of the weekend and hope that you pick the winners. We're going to be back on January the 6th, kicking off what should be, fingers crossed, an incredible year for the game of rugby union. We've got some superb guests lined up, some wonderful specials. We'll be on the ground in South Africa for the Lions, all things being equal with the world. And hopefully we will be in New Zealand for what should be an incredible Women's World Cup as well. Plus, as we build towards 2023, there are another couple of additions to the team. We'll leave you hanging on that. If you've missed any of our shows, then type in Good, Bad and Rugby into wherever you get your podcasts or into YouTube. And you'll find our back catalogue that includes Eddie Jones, Billy Vunipola, Jason Robinson, Johnny Sexton, and many, many more as well. That's also where you'll find our chaotic Christmas Zoom show, he writes his garb, with more guests than the Oscars. It was a lot of fun. It's taken quite some getting over. As MJT Ronnie in the YouTube comments said, this is exceptional. It's like being the designated driver and watching your mates making a twat of themselves repeatedly. Indeed it was. Thanks for your company and for all your support, all your messages, good and bad, the feedback, the love and the laughs. We've hopefully had a lot of fun in 2020. There is certainly a lot more to come in 2021. We'll be seeing you on the other side. Until then, it's all yours, Rob Brydon.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. It can't have been easy.